I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about 10 bucks a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. Have you ever eaten a pickle on a stick?
Yes, just now.
Do you think it tastes better than other kinds of pickles?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's on a stick, so you don't have to get all messy.
Because they're easier to eat and you don't have to get juice all over your hands.
It's almost like there's that mentality of it's a treat.
I don't know. It just enhances the pickle.
So you get the sourness and the bitter or the, all the pickle flavor, but you're eating it on a stick like it's a ice cream cone.
What do you think? What do you think? Pickle on a stick. Am I right?
Yeah.
How good is it? Right?
Delicious.
I don't understand what makes it better.
It's on a stick.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. Today, I'm coming to you from the 41st Annual Pickle Festival in Greenlawn, a suburb on Long Island. I've lived in the Greenlawn area for 10 years, and I can tell you, it's a great town. But it's not known for a whole lot. It's sandwiched between two bigger destination towns that have charming main streets and waterfront views. Greenlawn? Greenlawn has pickles. When I moved here, I learned that pickles used to be big business on Long Island. It was the local industry. In the late 1800s, Greenlawn was covered with cucumber farms. Long Island farmers were shipping 2,000 barrels of cucumbers for pickling into New York City every single day.
Till this day, the finest pickle is still a Long Island cucumber.
And what makes Long Island pickles better?
It's the weather and the soil.
But what I didn't know until pretty recently is that back when Greenlawn was covered with cucumber farms, there was a guy in town known as the Pickle King. Someone who, for a long time, was left out of a lot of the history of pickles on Long Island. But for now, back to the festival. It happens every September and I never miss it. It's at the Gardner Farm, where there's a big red barn, kids riding a miniature train, corn maze, there are hot dogs, corn dogs, booths selling arts and crafts, and a guy performing covers of Billy Joel, patron saint of Long Island.
I'm in a New York state.
And of course, there are pickles. Barrels and barrels of pickles, which you can buy in big containers or solo on a stick. What's your favorite pickle?
The new dill pickle.
That's like a half sour, right?
Yeah,
right.
I like new dill.
Yeah, yeah. I like them too because they taste like a half a cucumber, half a pickle.
Yeah.
The whole town's out here. There are people I know left and right, like my friend Mike Dempsey. Mike, you're born and raised here in Greenlawn, is that right?
Yes, it is.
As you chomp on a pickle, what does this day mean to you?
It's awesome. And it's honestly, it's a place where I brought my kids now for almost 10 years straight.
When you were growing up, was it a known thing, Greenlawn and pickles? Did you talk about it then?
Yes.
Was it a lesson in third grade?
It was just in the ether around the town. It was just always known that pickles were a part of our history.
So where are we, Robert?
We're at the John Gardner Farm in Greenlawn, which is an old farm stand going back to the mid-1700s.
I went back to the Gardner Farm on a day when the Pickle Festival wasn't happening, so I could meet the official town historian, Robert Hughes. In its prime, the Gardner Farm was likely a couple hundred acres. The Gardners inherited the land through marriage, and it stayed in the family for generations until the last heir gave it to the local historical society. In 1858, Alexander Gardner bought some land from his mother and tried his hand at a number of industries. He ran a sawmill, ice house, a brickyard. Then, shortly after the Civil War, a railroad was built on Long Island and Greenlawn got a stop. that was a game changer. The train made it a lot easier to transport goods to New York City, 40 miles away, which opened up a big new market for local farmers. Around that same time, Alexander Gardner had an idea. Pickles.
Alexander Gardner, who we consider the pickle pioneer, he grew up here. He's sort of the person who said, hey, we should start growing cucumbers and having them pickled in Greenlawn and on Long Island.
Do we know why cucumbers in particular as opposed to any other vegetable?
For some reason, he just had the vision. It must have been a call for pickles.
Right.
It's like anyone else, any good entrepreneur. You recognize there's a market need and you fill that need. And other people saw how successful he was with it and they just adopted it because you'd go where the money is. And that was the cash crop of the day.
Gardner built processing plants that other cucumber growers could rent out to pickle their own crop. Pretty soon, Greenlawn had a thriving cucumber industry.
And there were pickling houses at the railroad station as well. It's where they would pickle the cucumbers.
Is a pickling house literally just a house? Is it a factory?
Small factory.
So the farmers from the Greenlawn area would grow their cucumbers and they would bring them to the pickling houses by the train station. And that's where the cucumbers would be turned into pickles.
Right, and then shipped into the city.
But even though Alexander Gardner had this idea to turn Long Island into a pickle mecca, he's not the person who would be known as the Pickle King. That title would belong to someone else, a man by the name of Samuel Boulton.
Samuel Boulton was born in Westmoreland, Virginia in 1838, born into slavery.
Samuel was one of nine children. When he was 7 years old, he was hired out to a nearby plantation where he lived and worked for years.
He met a woman named Rebecca, and they eventually got married in 1861, just before the Civil War began.
Shortly after they were married, they were pulled apart. Samuel was conscripted by the Confederacy to work on the railroads in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Rebecca stayed at the plantation. Samuel bided his time, and eventually, he and a few friends attempted to escape the Confederacy.
Saturday night, they started walking, and by Wednesday morning, they were in Fredericksburg, about 70 miles away.
From there, Samuel spent a couple years cooking for a Union Army regiment in Wisconsin. But he kept thinking about Rebecca. Eventually, he made a decision. He needed to help her escape the plantation, escape slavery. To do that, he'd have to return to the South, to Virginia, where he himself was still a wanted man.
And on the way back, he would run into Confederate soldiers, and he would convince them that he had been captured by Northern troops, but he was making his way back home to the plantation. So obviously he was a very convincing man.
Samuel made it back to the plantation where Rebecca was, and they were reunited. But he decided it was too risky at that time to try to get her out. He snuck back out and waited. A few months later, he went to her again and received a surprise. Rebecca was pregnant with their first child. Samuel decided now was the time to escape.
And then he did rescue her while she was pregnant. And they walked 50 miles in a matter of 14 hours or so, some incredible amount of distance just to get back to the northern lines and safety. So he actually escaped three times. He was never captured, but he escaped three times. He was persuasive, and I guess he had his wits about him enough to realize what the role he had to play at that moment was in order to survive.
Samuel and Rebecca settled in Alexandria, Virginia, where the Union had a stronghold. That's where their first son was born. Towards the end of the Civil War, Samuel fought for the Union Army in Massachusetts and New Orleans, while Rebecca and their son stayed in Virginia. In 1873, the Boulton family moved, this time to Greenlawn. And this was right around when Alexander Gardner began farming cucumbers and when the train station was built. Samuel took a job with a white farmer in the area, but within 2 years, he was working his own land and leasing more on top of that.
I think he was up to 26 acres at one point that he was actively farming.
What was the business relationship? I'm assuming he's leasing land from white farmers.
Right. So, you know, some people might say he was sort of a sharecropper, but I think it was a little different than that. And farmers often lease out their land to other people to graze cattle or to actively grow crops. So, you know, he was the tenant and they were the landlord.
In the decade after Samuel Boulton arrived in town, the pickle industry continued to expand. A newspaper article from the time talks about how Greenlawn farmers had grown 32 million pickles that year.
And the only farmer mentioned by name was Samuel Boulton because he had grown 1.5 million.
1.5 million pickles grown in one season. Now, we don't have records to tell us how this compares to others. But since Boulton was the only farmer mentioned by name in an article about Greenlawn producing so many pickles, It seems safe to say this was considered a lot of pickles for one farmer to grow.
And maybe because he was a black man, they thought that was worthy of note. But he must have been well enough known in the community that the name would mean something when people were reading it.
Samuel Bolton would become better known in the community, not just in Greenlawn, but around Huntington, which is the larger area of Long Island that includes Greenlawn. In 1900, he was profiled in the local paper. He'd gotten into the hospitality business. He ran a boarding house, built a number of houses around town. He operated a dining tent at the local fairgrounds. For a while, he worked as a buyer for a pickle house in Boston. By the time this article came out, Samuel had solidified his place in the Greenlawn community. Add to that those 1.5 million pickles, and he had earned his famous nickname, the Pickle King.
He had a real dedication. He was a go-getter. He was always doing something to make money and to be active in the community.
As I said to Robert Hughes, hearing the story of Samuel Bolton made me question a lot of what I was taught about slavery and enslaved people when I was growing up. First, in the movies I saw as a kid, when the enslaved people were on the auction block, the biggest, strongest black man always went for the most money. The message I got was, these people were brought here for their muscle, to work the fields. But in fact, enslaved people had tremendous agricultural expertise that helped American farming flourish as an industry. One example that I learned from the writer Michael Twitty, Europeans didn't know how to grow rice. Enslaved African Americans taught them. And you see that agricultural expertise in Samuel Bolton. The other thing is that growing up in the New York area, I was always taught about slavery and enslaved people as something that happened in the South. And black contributions to American food are so centered in the South. I appreciated learning that there's black American food history right down the street from me, which suggests it's probably right down the street from a lot of us, whether or not we learned about it in school. I just don't hear very many stories of black people at that time contributing anything. I mean, those stories don't seem to be the ones that get told.
Right. No, it's a very underappreciated and under-understood aspect of local history, because there was slavery on Long Island and in Huntington. About 6% of the population at one point was enslaved in Huntington. So it was smaller scale, but no less horrific for the people who were enslaved.
Where do you see Samuel Bolton's legacy today?
I think the legacy of Samuel Bolton is that he was someone who managed to get ahead under what must have been difficult circumstances because of his background of growing up enslaved, his being a black man in a white community. But nonetheless, he persevered and he tried many different endeavors and was successful in many different endeavors and managed to raise a family here and became, I think, a respected member of the community. You see the pictures of the Memorial Day parades, and he's there in his Civil War uniform, right out there with all the other veterans. You know, some people say it looks like he's sort of front and center in some of those photographs, that people were proud to have him as part of their community.
Coming up, Samuel Bolton gets new recognition in Greenlawn, and I learn more about his family by talking with some of his descendants. Stick around.
Hope you're hungry, because it's time for some ads.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants: Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature alfresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. And you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com. This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. We have a dog. Her name is Sasha. She's almost four. She's a standard poodle. She's black and fluffy and soft and very adorable. And when we first got her, we took her to like this puppy kindergarten training class. The whole family went and, you know, they're teaching how to use the treats and all this. The trainer watched Sasha for a bit and said, she's very food motivated. And my daughter Emily turned to me and said, she's a Pashman. And so she is food motivated. And that's why we make a point of feeding Sasha high quality pet food. Founded in Hereford, Texas, Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. Real is Merrick's recipe, so they always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. And let me tell you something. When it's dinner time, Sasha is motivated, okay? She is highly motivated to come in from patrolling the backyard at dinner, to get up off the couch, whatever she's doing, she will drop it and come running. Check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. I continue to get a lot of flack for my PB&J technique, okay? Jelly on the top, jelly on the bottom, peanut butter in the middle. That's the way to go. And the first thing people say is, well, when you spread the jelly on both sides and then spread the peanut butter on top, you're going to tear the bread. And my answer to you is, use better bread. Like Hero Bread. You get that whole wheat Hero Bread. It's got some grain. It's got some heft. It's got some flavor. It's got some texture. And it will stand up to my excellent PB&J technique. Hero makes delicious breads that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, but plenty of protein and fiber. The soft, fluffy experience you love when enjoying a refreshing BLT, a savory breakfast burrito, or a mouthwatering cheeseburger, you can have all that with Hero Breads. And let me tell you, we are a big burrito-eating family in our house. Breakfast burritos happen multiple times a week, and these Hero Flour tortillas are perfect for it. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co, that's hero.co, and use code SPORKFUL at checkout for that discount. That's code SPORKFUL at hero.co. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know the peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. I know you love it when my mom is on the podcast, right? Well, guess what? She's in this podcast. Listen to the very end of this episode to hear her recipe for, I'll just say it, the best veggie dip I've ever tasted, which I adapt using Hellmann's Spicy Mayonnaise. You're going to love this segment and the recipe. Stay tuned to the end for that. One more thing. Remember a few years ago when everyone was getting an Instant Pot? Well, recently the company filed for bankruptcy. In last week's episode, I find out what happened. And we take a spin through some other hot topics in food. I talk with food writer Dennis Lee about getting his local Burger King to recreate Burger King Thailand's cheeseburger. This cheeseburger is just 20 slices of cheese, no meat.
I have never seen anything like it. It was hilarious. Like, this thing was just melt, like a melted mound of plastic. It was shiny. It like reflected in your face. Like you could probably see a reflection in it. And we both took bites of it right in the middle where the pile of cheese was the tallest.
You got to listen to the episode to find out what Dennis thought of it and to hear about other pressing news from the world of food, including whether aspartame is actually bad for you. That's up now. Check it out. Now back to the story of the Pickle King of Green Lawn. Samuel Boulton died in 1917. A few years later, a blight arrived. A fungus stunted the cucumber's growth, and they turned white and got too hard to eat. Nobody could find a fix. Farmers quit planting cucumbers, and Green Lawn's pickle industry basically disappeared. It would be decades before the town would acquire its other claim to fame. On March 27, 1969, Mariah Carey was born. She's from Green Lawn. My friend Todd claims when she was in high school, she threw up in the basement bathroom of the house he now owns. I can't verify that claim, but Todd does give tours if you're interested. Fortunately, kids growing up here still know about the town's connection to pickles. The park behind the library is named Pickle Park, and every September there's the Pickle Festival, where I met a group of college-age women.
I've come here as a kid, and I thought I'd bring my friends. And I told her about it, and she had to come fly here for it.
She came from England for the Pickle Festival.
That can't be true.
No, it's true.
It is true.
Well, first of all, she loves pickles. It's kind of like her favorite thing. Like, you think Lauren, and then you kind of think pickle.
Yeah, very true. Yeah.
But I was like, well, you have to come to the Pickle Festival. It's every year.
Lauren, is it everything you expected it would be?
Everything more. The most American thing I've ever been to in my entire existence.
In recent years, more people have learned about Samuel Balton, thanks to the work of the area's African American Historic Designation Council and other town leaders. The council was formed in 2005, and they've been slowly bringing more attention to Samuel Balton's story. They began by putting on some local exhibits about him at the town church and at the train station. A few years later, they put up a couple of historical markers around town, small signs near houses he built that share a bit of his story. Then, in 2021, the council recommended that a street be renamed for the Pickle King.
Good morning. I welcome all of you and invite you to share the history of African Americans in the town of Huntington.
This is Irene Moore, chair of the African American Historic Designation Council, speaking at the street renaming ceremony. The town of Huntington that she's referring to is the local governing body for Green Lawn, so some people use the town names interchangeably. Irene first learned about Samuel Balton when she moved to the area in 1970. She says, for the most part, the local black community was always familiar with the Pickle King. But until recently, his story wasn't widely publicized or taught in schools.
As you know, African American history is not only Huntington's history, but is American's history. So again, thank all of you for coming. Thanks again for being here.
The street being renamed is pretty short, a section of Boulevard Avenue with a couple of houses that ends in a cul-de-sac. It was chosen because Samuel Balton lived in the house on the corner. That street would now be known as Samuel Balton Way. On the day of the renaming, the block was closed. There was a podium set up. Several local politicians were there to speak. There was a pretty good crowd for a small town.
Wow, what a turnout for Sam Balton, huh? You know, as I read about Sam
A few Balton, Civil War reenactors were there in Union Army uniforms. Some teachers and students from the school district came. There was even a local TV news truck and some special guests.
And we also have the family from Sam Balton's descendants here. William H. Balton II, also Carl Balton, his great-great-grandchild. Give them a round of applause to the family who's come from far and wide to be here with us today.
Come on. Carl Balton, Samuel Balton's great-great-grandson, got up to speak.
The first thing that impressed me about Sam was the great love that he had for his wife, Rebecca. A love that caused him to risk his life to free her from slavery. So he was a great family man. I learned that he was also a great civic leader and a builder, as much of his handiwork remains to this day. And finally, I learned that he was a fantastic businessman. He was indeed the Pickle King. So thank you on behalf of the Balton family.
After the ceremony, I spoke with Carl Balton, who now lives in Georgia.
I am the oldest living Balton, and I'm 74 years old. So, you know, I didn't really have a lot of knowledge of my father's family. I saw a slave narrative that talked about the Sam and Rebecca Balton story, and that's really when I first really learned about Sam. So it was just amazing to me. And so we were able to come up here, and I went through the Historical Society and saw the exhibit and everything that they have for him. And so that was a revelation.
Off to the side, I noticed a couple other Balton relatives. They were younger, late 20s, early 30s. And they'd come all the way from L.A. for the ceremony. Sorry, can you just both tell me your names, please?
Leanne Balton.
My name is Brian Balton.
Samuel Balton was Leanne's great-great-great-grandfather. When she discovered the story of her ancestor,
I was like, wait, what? I love pickles. Do you mean that I could possibly be the pickle princess? That is amazing. I gotta eat more pickles.
In recent years, more stories of black Americans like Samuel Balton have come to light. Now I pass his street whenever I drop my kids off at school, and I enjoy sharing his story with them when we go to the Pickle Festival each year. A few months after the street renaming ceremony, I called up Leanne Balton to talk about how all this has affected her.
That was a beautiful experience to come down and see them rename the street after him. Sorry, just emotional, sorry. just being able to stand on that, you know, the front lawn of the property that he built. I always saw pictures, but I had never been there. It was really emotional.
Have you and your family had a chance to sort of reflect on that day?
We had a family meeting over Zoom, and we were able to share our experiences, and a lot of the family members that wanted to come and couldn't. A lot of them were just really overwhelmed with joy and excited, and a lot of that side of my family, they're older, so they were just thankful that they were able to find out more information. So we really got to just share in that experience together as a family, and it actually brought us closer together, especially for our younger generations that were on that call. It was really like good for them to really get to understand and grasp a lot of the stories that, you know, I didn't get to at their age.
You know, coming to Green Lawn, standing in the spot where Samuel Bolton stood, learning more details of his story than you knew before, how did that change the way you think of yourself?
It's helped me overcome doubting myself and kind of like being hesitant to try new things. It's kind of pushed me to just keep pushing forward and initiating new ideas. And I just always hold that notion of that, you know, he was a leader and he was able to accomplish so much. And I have that too. I can do that same thing.
A few years ago, I spoke with Dr. Jessica B. Harris for an episode of the show. She spent her career uncovering the ways that Black Americans have fundamentally shaped food in this country. In that conversation, I asked her what impact those stories had on her.
My spine may have straightened a little bit more. I might have, you know, walked a little taller and been a little bit prouder. I think that this whole notion of hidden heroes, and we've got so many hidden or stolen or strayed
or erased.
Erased African Americans in all realms, not just the culinary, that deserve, that cry out for reestablishment.
I told Dr. Harris about Samuel Bolton, and I told her how Green Lawn, this mostly white town in the Long Island suburbs, isn't where I expected to find a story like his.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that's so fascinating is that he is in the suburbs of Long Island. But because if you begin to think about it in those terms, when we start talking about these hidden heroes, that if they can be found in this town, Green Lawn, in Long Island, unexpectedly, then how many other stories are there?
My thanks to everyone who I spoke with in this episode. The 43rd annual Green Lawn Pickle Festival will take place at the John Gardner Farm in Green Lawn on September 16th from 10 to 4. Come experience the magic of pickles on a stick. Who knows, maybe Mariah Carey will be there. But probably not. I don't think she's been back in a while. Next week on the show, I travel to rural Virginia to go foraging with a man who's carrying on a family tradition and supplying high-end ingredients to local restaurants. That's next week. While you wait for that one, check out last week's episode in which we take a spin through some hot topics in the world of food, from Instant Pot's bankruptcy to Burger King Thailand's cheeseburger to much more. That one's up now. This episode was produced by me along with senior producer
Emma Morgenstern
and producers
Andres O'Hara
and
Johanna Mayer.
The show is edited by
Camille Stanley.
Our engineer is
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher Studios. Our executive producers are Colin Anderson and Nora Ritchie. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Karen on Long Island, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
I'm heading to a party, and I want to bring a variation on my mom's famous veggie dip, but I don't quite remember her recipe, so I'm calling her up.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey.
Can you remind me your recipe for that veggie dip that you do?
You mean the mustard dill?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you just take Hellman's mayonnaise, some salt and pepper,
squeeze in some lemon juice, and it's probably about 2/3 mayo to 1/3 Dijon.
Dijon mustard.
And then chop up some dill.
Do you feel like it has to be Hellman's mayonnaise?
Yes, because Hellman's is, to me, has the flavor closest to homemade mayonnaise.
You've been doing this veggie dip for I mean, I feel like I remember this when I was a kid, you would roll out this veggie dip.
Yeah, but I used to do just mustard and mayo, but then I decided I got exotic and added dill. Mustard, mayonnaise, and dill just works.
And what do you dip into it?
Oh, well, that is especially shrimp, but also veggies, but it's really delicious with shrimp.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
What kind of reactions do you usually get when you make this dip?
People say, that's delicious. How do you make it?
Well, I want to try making this veggie dip of yours, but using the Hellman's spicy mayonnaise.
Okay. And I think adding heat to it would be very good.
I'm going to go make the Hellman's spicy mayo veggie version of your veggie dip and try it.
Okay.
All right, I'm in the kitchen. Time to mix up a batch of my mom's famous veggie dip, but this time with Hellman's spicy mayonnaise. Hellman's mayonnaise, Dijon mustard, lemon, dill. Grab a salt and pepper in a sec. All right, now she said 2-to-1 ratio mayo to mustard. First, in goes the Hellman's spicy mayonnaise. Dijon mustard. Give this a little mix. Time for the lemon juice. A little salt, ground pepper, chop up the dill. And now, grab a baby carrot to taste. Mmm! This is already such a good dip, and the addition of the spicy mayo is next level. Absolute next level. Tart, creamy, spicy, it's got everything. In fact, I'm gonna bring it to a party right now. All right, one more bite before that. Mmm! Party time! So I'm on my way home from the party. The dip was a huge hit. The spice from the mayonnaise, the lemon juice, the Dijon, it's just firing on all cylinders. It is so full of flavor. It is so savory. So it's a great recipe. Thanks, Mom. And made even better with Hellman's spicy mayonnaise, which, by the way, is made with real chili peppers. And let me tell you, there's a bunch of other great things you can do with this Hellman's spicy mayonnaise. They have a bunch of recipes when you go to hellmans.com/spicy. Including an incredible spicy crispy chicken sandwich. Again, that's hellmans.com/spicy. Deliciously spicy, 100% Hellmann's.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' Cold Coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's Cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.